Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, and was raised by his mom in government-subsidized housing. He began working at age 14 in a drugstore and became a bank messenger after graduating high school. In 1980, he and Bob Howe co-founded Atlantic Data Services, and today is its president and chief executive officer. His life's been profiled in a book entitled Follow the Yellow Brick Road. His name, Bill Gallagher. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Bill Gallagher, the president and chief executive officer of Atlantic Data Services. Bill, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. It's an honor to be here. Follow on some of the fabulous guests you've had in the past. That's a humbling experience for me.
Thanks. Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Sure. I grew up in Boston, the second oldest of four children, all of which were born within 5 years. My parents were typical post-World War II newlyweds. We lived in Roxbury to begin with, which is a suburb of Boston. And when I was about 4 years old, my father was an alcoholic. He was a carpenter by trade, but he was a pretty severe alcoholic. And my mother made the decision that she was going to have to either decide between living that lifestyle or stepping up to her responsibilities as a parent, and decided at that point that she could not save my father and made him leave the house. They never did get divorced, but she effectively kicked him out and took on the responsibility of bringing the four of us up alone. And at that point, we moved into what is still the largest housing project in New England that was available to World War II veterans, went on welfare, and really started about a 15 to 16 year phase where it was basically the five of us, my mother and the four kids, making it on our own. And in a very strong, supportive Catholic environment, that was a wonderful experience. My brother and sisters and I never felt we were poor, never felt we were deprived of anything. A very close, very supportive group of people.
What's the biggest things you learned from your mom?
Well, I think the strongest thing we learned from my mother and from the decision that she made was that you always have to recognize and do the right thing. Step up and take responsibility. It was clear to me when I got into my 30s and 40s, only at that time, the sacrifice my mother made by saying, this is now my job, I'm going to take it on and it's going to be my responsibility and I'm going to make sure that it comes out right. And that's an ethic that permeates our family. That and the fact that we never, even given our circumstances, we never felt there wasn't anything that we could accomplish, that we were only limited by our imagination and our willingness to work hard at something.
How did your mom make ends meet?
Well, we were on welfare. We were on aid to families with dependent children. We were very, very poor when I was young. But as soon as any one of us was able to get part-time employment, we did it. And even till I was probably 20, every nickel I ever made, I only kept what I needed to sustain myself, and everything else went back into the family. That was the ethic of our family.
We've known each other for 20 years.
Right.
You've always revered your mom. What do you say to someone who's 40, 50, 60 that says, I hate my mom, I don't like my mom? What do you say to that person?
I think the only thing that you can say, and I have said to people, is there's got to be an underlying reason. There's got to be something that's not right. There are abusive moms. There are mothers who bring children into this world addicted to drugs. And it's just, they can be doing terrible things to their children, but it's unnatural for a child to not have a loving relationship with their mother and their father. So if somebody is so vehemently against their mother, there's got to be something else there. There's got to be some other reason that something happened, that there's a resentment, that the mother didn't do something for them. What mother might not have been strong enough for them. Mother may not have protected them enough in their mind, something like that. But it's always some other underlying thing. I think it's a natural human thing for a child to love their parents and to trust their parents and to want to have a loving relationship with them. So it's got to be an external factor that caused that to happen.
Bill, what advice would you give to today's single moms trying to raise kids?
I think that's a real important question, Jack, to me, and it's not just to have to do with single moms. I think that there's an awful lot of pressure on mothers today to not stand up for what they know to be the natural, correct way to bring children up and to the right relationship to have with children. There's too much pressure on women to make sure that the kids are happy, make sure that the kids like them, make sure that they in some cases the father is not bothered with the problems of the kids, is not burdened with having to bring the kids up and to deal with the kids' problems. But I think it's a terrible mistake for any woman to abdicate her natural instincts and her natural nurturing and strengthening instincts in child care. Divorce, you see it in divorces all the time, where the divorced parents compete for the affection and attention of the kids. That's always the wrong thing to do. It's always at the expense of the kids in the long run.
As you got older, did you have a relationship with your dad?
No, it was funny. My mother called me when I was first engaged to my wife Penny, whom you know, and she said she heard that my father was in the VA hospital dying of liver cancer in his 50s. And we felt bad. I hadn't seen him since I was probably 6 or 7 years old. And she said to me, "You know, it's our responsibility to take care of him now. We have to be by his side when he dies. We have to take care of his funeral arrangements."
We're talking to Bill Gallagher, and I'm Jack Grasula. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJI.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Bill Gallagher. Bill, you're 14 years old, and you get your first full-time job. Talk about that.
Sure, Jack. I lived in what is the south end of Boston, which is was at that time a thriving neighborhood in the early 60s. I was going to high school in Boston, and I was on the track team at Brighton High School, and as I mentioned earlier, as soon as we could, we were responsible to bring in as much income into the family as possible. At this point, my mother had a job selling for a TV Guide. She used to sell subscriptions to TV Guide, but I ended up getting a job at a drugstore on Blue Hill Avenue, which is a relatively tough district of Boston. After school, I'd work from 4 to 10. And I, every day, and then I'd work Saturdays. And basically, I was a soda jerk in those days. But the interesting part of that job is doctors could phone in pharmacy orders for people who were sick at home, and I would carry the drugs to these people's houses after supper. And I didn't know what I had in the bag, but I'd have a bag, I remember Mr. Schiff, the man who owned the pharmacy, said, "It's a good thing you're on the track team." My suggestion is you run all the way down there. When you get the money, run all the way back. And so I did that for a few years. And after that, I got a job working at Boston City Hospital at their remote hospital, which is one of the islands in Boston. My brother got the same job, and we were orderlies at that hospital. We would actually stay overnight out there and work the second shift and take the bus to school in the morning.
What do you say to parents in the suburbs today who have teenage kids and they're considering whether they should encourage these kids to get jobs?
I think it's a great thing for kids to have responsibility once they're teenagers. I think the balance between four things, school, athletics, employment responsibility, and then your social networking, it's really what rounds out kids at that level. And it doesn't make really doesn't make much difference what kind of a job they have or even how much money they make. But if there's some place that they have to be and they're accountable to a boss, a manager, not their mom and dad, not their teacher, not their friends, for getting their work done, I think it's great.
Kids will tell you in these suburbs, you know, I can't have a job because kids will laugh at me. They'll mock me. When you were a kid, being poor, how did you handle that criticism, that razzing from kids?
I honestly don't remember ever being razzed about having a job. I think kids pick on other kids if they are socially outcast. But by that I mean is I was always playing basketball, running track. I was always at all the parties and dances. I was big in the CYO. And to have that social network working and also having an employment, it was perfectly okay. Nobody ever razzed me about working.
How did you ever get into the banking industry?
Well, that's an interesting story. When I graduated from high school, I used to jump on the T, which is the transportation system in Boston, take it into Boston, and go to employment companies that were placing people for jobs. And I did two or three different jobs. I was a painter for a while. I worked in a real estate management firm as a janitor, if you will, coming out of high school. And finally, one day, a job opened up for what was the mailroom at one of the larger mid-sized banks in Boston. And I took that job. And it basically turned out to be somebody who would open envelopes in the morning, stuff envelopes at night with mortgage bills and bank statements. And in the middle of the day, I would be a courier for the bank. And by that, I mean, this was before there was wire transfers and things like that. If the bank wanted to move securities between two financial institutions, they'd put them in a briefcase, handcuff the briefcase to me, and tell me, go down to the Federal Reserve Bank with this briefcase. There's a guy down there who has a key. He'll open it for you and bring it back. And I thought I had the best job in the world. I could roam around the city of Boston in the middle of the day and see all the sights. But one day it just dawned on me, and I said to the treasurer of the bank, am I risking my life doing this? And he said, no, you're not. I said, what's in the bag here? What's in the attaché case? I have a natural curiosity. So over the next two or three years, I would sit out in front of the president of the bank's office, and I would converse with this president. Al Cole was his name. He was just a marvelous man. And I would say to him, well, tell me, how does this securities work? And he'd explain the whole securities business to me. And I'd say, how does loan interest work? And he'd explain that. And how do all these various calculation methods in banking work? And I got literally what I would consider to be an advanced degree in banking by just conversing with that man for over a couple of years.
For a listener tonight, first-generation American, who says, wow, you're a rags-to-riches story. Today you consult with the CEOs of the largest banks in the world, Bill. And if the kid said, is that still possible in America today for me to do something like that? What do you tell them?
I think that those opportunities are still available, I'm not to say that there aren't people who are restricted or don't have access to those opportunities, but I think that America still is an area where invention and creation and intuition and initiative can still take you as far as you can go. There is nothing in the society or the economy that's preventing people from being able to do that. Now, they may have some personal limitations. They may have a situation that prevents it, but I don't think there's anything in America that prevents it.
In 1980, you and Bob Howe co-found Atlantic Data Services.
Right.
How did that ever happen?
Well, the bank I worked for, as it turned out, had put in one of the very first computer systems and online computer systems in banking. They tested everybody in the bank, IBM did, to see who had the aptitude to be a programmer. And they used it as a PR thing in the bank, and I ended up getting the highest score, one of the highest scores ever recorded by IBM. So they kind of had to let me become a programmer. So for that bank, I programmed for a couple of years. before I did a couple of years in the Army too. And then that bank got together with 28 other banks, and they created a bank processing company. And I applied for a job and got a job there. And that's where I met my partner, Bob Howe. And over the next 9 years, Bob and I started at the two lowest positions and became the two most senior players in that organization, reporting to the president. And in 1979, the president decided he was going to leave the company, and he went to the board and said, boy, you got two fabulous guys here. You got to see if you can hang on to them. And have them run the company. But the board decided to go in a different direction. So we went to the board and said, you know, we think there's an opportunity here to become a consultant to the banking industry along the areas of operations and data processing. And they didn't agree with us. So we decided we'd just go out on our own and start the business and be that company. And that's what we've been doing for the past 27 and a half years.
We're talking to Bill Gallagher, who's one of the greatest salespeople I've ever met in my life. When we come back, we'll ask him about selling. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Bill Gallagher. Webster's Dictionary defines to sell or selling as to cause or persuade, to accept, to convince. Bill, in your opinion, what's selling?
Well, I think that's a pretty good definition of selling, Jack, but I think what for me, what selling really comes down to is one individual influencing the decisions of another person. And it's at the 20,000-foot level, I think that's really the way you have to look at it, because selling, a lot of people think selling is a not a distasteful occupation, but it's something that they don't want to be known as having done, something that they're not good at. But pretty much selling goes on across the board in human society, from pastors of churches are great salespeople, teachers are great salespeople. Certainly, people who do selling as a profession are great salespeople. They're so good at it, they're willing to put part of their compensation at risk if they don't sell well. I think that's about the only difference. And one of the things that people, even in our industry, have to realize is that everybody is selling. You're either selling negatively or selling positively every day. Our company is a consultancy. We have a traditional sales force. But we remind every one of our consultants all the time, you are really the predominant sales force of this organization.
If you read any book on sales, if you go to any sales seminar, they all say that a person sells three things and in a certain order. What are they?
That's a pretty traditional and very authentic and accurate depiction of what selling is. You first of all have to sell yourself. Selling, as I said, occurs between two people. Not between an envelope someone gets in the mail and a buyer. You have to first develop a relationship and a value proposition, or be acknowledged as somebody that the buyer is interested in personally. Then second, you have to sell your organization, the integrity of your organization, and the reliability, the sustainability of your organization, the history of your organization is what has to come second. And then finally, you're in a position to sell the product or service that you're now talking to the customer about. But it is first yourself, then your company, and then the product or service.
We're talking to Bill Gallagher, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Bill Gallagher, whose life is being profiled in a book entitled Follow the Yellow Brick Road, due to be published later this year. Bill, what makes a great salesperson?
Well, I think that's a simple one to answer, Jack. I think a great salesperson is somebody who can relate to the requirements of the buyer and can bring almost immediately start to bring value and start to allow to develop the relationship and allow the buyer to recognize that, hey, this is a person who not only cares about what my issues are, has invested some time in finding out about what they are specifically to me, and has some insights and value and knowledge as to what I can do about them. A good salesperson, as everybody said, is a good listener, first of all. Because to really be effective in selling, you have to take input. But that's not enough. You have to be able to formulate a plan. Almost the best people can do it extemporaneously. While I'm talking to you and I'm hearing you talk about things, I can start to develop an idea that I can start to propose to you and get your reaction and mold it and grow it. And we're almost together coming up with, oh, yeah, that makes sense. This is what we probably should be doing. That's, to me, is the greatest salesperson. There's some great examples of salespeople. Doctors who are great diagnosticians are great salespeople because they're listening. They've got all the background of their medical training and experience, and they're starting to now ask the appropriate questions and then formulating a solution for the patient that's going to work, that's based on the input they got, their knowledge, and their experience. That's a selling experience when that happens between a doctor and a patient, although most people will tell you it's not. But that's exactly what happens at the highest levels of corporate selling. Somebody with good experience, good listening skills, and the ability to formulate a plan is talking to somebody who needs something. And together they work out this treatment plan, if you will, and they do it on terms that are mutually acceptable, and they have a sale. So it's listening and the ability to formulate solutions.
Being on the golf course with you many times through the years, you evidently have never run into a great golf pro, teaching pro.
That's true.
Who's been a salesperson.
That's
huh?
true. That's true.
He sells you a lot of clubs and stuff, but not the how-to book.
That's right. A lot of equipment.
Talk about overcoming objections. Some great salespeople say the sale doesn't begin until you hear the word no.
Right, right. I think overcoming objections is one of the most important aspects of selling. And I what's interesting to me, successful selling is, I think it's like Yogi would say, 90% perspiration, 50% inspiration. Selling, it's really personality driven. You've got the DNA to be a good salesperson, and then you can have lots and lots of training, but all the training in the world is not going to make somebody with the wrong DNA a good salesperson. Overcoming objections is one of the key things to selling, because what you should look at it as, when you get an objection, your reaction should be, well, wait a minute, maybe I don't understand the issue well enough, or maybe I'm not explaining my solution to you well enough. But unfortunately, I see a lot of people, when they run up against objection, take it personally. It's the axiom I use is, don't behave as if people told you your baby's ugly. You find out, maybe it's my fault. Maybe I didn't understand what you really wanted. But the people that don't have the right DNA, right off the bat, they think, oh, this person just told me my baby's ugly. Their ego gets in the way.
Speaking of which, what role does ego play in being a successful salesperson?
I think it's like cholesterol in your DNA. There's good ego and there's bad ego. There's a good ego that gets you out of bed every day, that makes you want to put points on the board, that makes you want to score and be successful. But there's bad ego. Too much ego, you get into the bad ego, your cholesterol is too high. Bad ego is when you encounter objections. Your ego strength is so strong that you have no alternative other than to blame the person who just objected. And you think of them as, they're stupid. They're not smart enough to understand what I'm doing, what my recommendation is. They're not bright enough. It's always somebody else's fault, never yours. And that can become a real, almost, you can't overcome that obstacle if you've got too strong an ego that puts you into that position.
It seems to me that the salespeople with healthy ego, they're humble.
No question about it. No question about it. When somebody says to you, "No, that's not what I want," it's a Y turn at that point. You go in one of two directions. He's a jerk. He doesn't know what I have. I'm going to go find somebody else who wants to buy what I want. I'm going to blame it on him. It's not my fault. It's not my product or service. It's his fault that he doesn't see the value of it. And I'll go in that direction. Whereas somebody else who has their ego in check says, wait a minute, why would you react that way? I need to understand why you don't think it's that good of an idea. Did I explain it wrong? Did I not understand what you really need? Let's talk about that. And an objection, when you come to an objection, a good salesperson sees it as an opportunity to more strongly clarify what their value proposition is, not to discard the buyer as an uninformed buyer.
Can you give us a story about a real-life person being humble?
Absolutely. I think you see it all the time, but I think sales is a natural profession in society. And as I mentioned earlier, I think that ministers, priests are salespeople. They're selling value. They're selling the benefit of religion and the benefit of living a good life and so forth. And I think one of the greatest examples of humility at the point of confrontation that I ever saw was Cardinal Bernardin in Chicago. As most people will remember, he was accused of some pretty terrible crimes by a young man in Chicago. And this was a precursor or at the beginning of the priest scandal, which was a pretty emotional event in Boston. But it was amazing for me to watch Cardinal Bernardin as a prince of the church, when he's accused of such a terrible thing, his first instinct was not to defend himself, but to reach out to that young man and say, "Why did you say that? What's your problem? What's wrong?" And his strength and his handling of that was so much different than we saw at similar situations in other places, specifically in Boston, that his ego strength was in control, and his humility, his first instinct was to say, why would he do that? Not as opposed to defending himself and going after the accuser. And that turned out to be the perfect way for him to have handled that.
What do you say to the person, Bill, who says, "I'm not a salesman. I'm not a sales lady"?
Well, I think we have to understand, and everybody needs to understand, and it behooves organizations to make sure they make this clear to all of their employees. Every single person in the organization is a salesperson. When I know you're in the executive search business, Jack, and I've been involved in a lot of executive searches, and I've hired thousands of people and so forth. The receptionist that the candidate meets when they come in the door has just as much to do with closing the sale of hiring that person as any of the recruiters do. That first impression is unbelievable. And when I walk into an organization and I'm waiting to see an executive and I'm talking to either their receptionist, the guard in the lobby, their administrative assistant, I'm asking them, "Hey, how do you like working here? What do you think of the organization? Big changes have happened recently, haven't it?" And I want to hear from them if they think they've been good changes, or are they under strain. And those people don't realize, but they're selling me in those casual conversations, as effectively as any salesperson.
For 20 years that I've known you, you've been a constant student. You believe that you've got to keep earning while you're learning. You're always learning about psychology, people, a process, globalization. Why, Bill?
I think just as one would exercise, hopefully, and one would have their retirement finances under control, you have to constantly invest in yourself. I think that life is a journey, that at the core of your life, over your life, your goal is to develop your relationship, I believe, with God during your life. It's a constant thing. On this earth, you're never going to successfully get 100%. But you do have the opportunity to constantly invest in yourself and to make sure that you have, at the minimum, conversational credibility on almost any topic, because that's how you demonstrate that you care. That you care about yourself, that you care about important topics, that you care about what other people do, is that you can talk about them.
We're talking to Bill Gallagher, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Rasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Bill Gallagher, the president and CEO of Atlantic Data Services. Bill, what was ADS created to do in 1980?
Well, we started the firm as a local company in Boston that was very much involved in very difficult technology issues in the banking industry exclusively. Things like encryption systems for ATM cards and special check processing systems and hybrid branch technology systems. So I'd say a good 90 to 95% of our work was at the very lowest programming code level.
Watching you through the years and admiring you through the years, you've basically retooled ADS every 5 years. Why and how?
Well, I think what happens as any company that's serving a sophisticated, complex, changing market, you have to make sure that your company is always relevant to the market. And what does that mean? That you're offering something that they need and that they're willing to pay for. And that's going to change. It's going to change from, well, as I said, we started off as a very technical company. We soon became an analytical company. We then had to become very much experts in the finance industry. Then we had to become more project-oriented people. And now we're going through another transition where we even have to become more of an advisory consultative company to the industry.
What do you say to a longtime employee who is a naysayer that says, Bill, we're successful, we're growing, we're profitable. We don't have to change.
Well, you know, there's just so many examples of companies that took that position and where they didn't change, they became the bait rather than the large fish. You have to always be making sure that you're relevant to the trends in the market. Because in our business, we're like Major League Baseball. We have no annuity income. It doesn't make any difference if you win the World Series this year, as I'm sure the Red Sox will do. Next year, we start from scratch. You got to win your position on the roster. You got to bat for average. You got to bat for power. You got to hit your numbers every single year. You never get a free ride next year because you won the World Series this year. And that's something every employee has to understand.
What do you say to a person that says, Bill, when I hired in, you promised me. I trusted you. And now you're pulling the rug from under me here.
I think, hopefully we haven't done that. And I think it's important for a company to communicate to their employees all the time what the realities of employment in a capitalistic free market system is. What every company does for every employee, every good company, is they provide that employee the opportunity to not just survive, but to thrive. But the employee has to take advantage of that opportunity. There's a lot of jobs that we used to pay a fortune every year to a lot of people whose jobs now are in India. They're not in the United States anymore. And those people who didn't make the transition to improving their own skills, hopefully they either move to India with their job, or they're probably out of the industry now. So a company can only provide opportunity, but employees have to protect themselves and invest in themselves to make sure that they're relevant and can take advantage of those opportunities.
For 27 years, you basically have been a United Nations. You've employed people from all over the world. How have you regularly gotten a group of people from many countries and cultures, religions, to work as a team?
I think there's a couple of unique things that ADS has done, one of which is we are really a second employment company. By that I mean we can't hire anybody in the company that doesn't have at least 15 years of experience in the finance industry. So they're not coming out of college, they're not fresh with MBAs, they're pretty much seasoned people. And even as we sit here today, I'm proud to say that of our employee base, the average tenure with ADS is 11 years, which is a lifetime in our industry, and the average tenure in the finance industry is 22 years. So we've got a mature employee base to begin with. Second, it's our culture in our organization, because we run a dispersed operating model where our clients are all over the country and sometimes all over the world in terms of supporting their clients, that we have to have a culture and we have to have the tools and mechanisms to bring those people back together on projects, on internal communications, and so forth. And a good example of that is In June of this year, we ran our annual meeting and brought all the employees back into Boston. And we usually have like a five-hour program for them. It's a whole, we bring the employees and their spouses or guests, and it's a whole weekend in Boston. And everybody tells us the most important part of that five-hour meeting is the three-hour cocktail party. They don't want to hear from me. They don't care about having a fancy meal. They just want to be able to interact with each other and get to see their brothers and sisters, basically, in a social setting and catch up.
What do you look for when you hire people today, Bill?
In our organization, we look for people who first and foremost have the service ethic, that they have to recognize that they're the person delivering the value for our company. They have to realize it's the relationship between them and their client. Second, they have to have good communication skills, because the brightest person in the world who can't tell you where the fire escape is when the building catches fire is of no value to you whatsoever. Then they have to have a good work ethic, because it's a difficult job. They may think that they're going on an easy assignment. It's going to be 4 days a week for the next 3 months, but it may turn out to be 6 days a week for the next year. So they really have to be able to accept responsibility for what has to get done and do it.
The book that's coming out later this year, yep. Follow the Yellow Brick Road, Dr. Myra White, an expert in the psychological factors that make people into superstars. She highlights four people. Jack Welch.
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Ben Carson, one of the world's foremost pediatric neurosurgeons. Margaret Thatcher, the first and only female prime minister in Great Britain history. And this guy from this poor wrong side of the tracks in Boston, grew up on welfare, you know, drugstore at 14, a messenger boy in a bank. What do you think about that?
Well, it's very flattering. Myra's just a character. I was recommended to her by some people in Boston as a good example of. I think the reason that she wanted to put me in the book was because of my. I don't seem to have much pretense about why I'm successful or obstacles to success, and that's kind of what she focused on, kind of what we've been talking about today. She would say to me, "What made you think you could be successful and do this?" And my answer to her is, you know, I never thought about it. I still don't think about it. I just do what appears to be the appropriate thing to do, and it works out. So it's great company to be in. Her focus on the psychological orientation of people, I think I wouldn't speak for her, but she could say the same thing of Margaret Thatcher. What makes you think you could be the first woman Prime Minister of England? And her attitude would be, why not? Why couldn't I be? And that's my attitude.
Last question. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
I would say that it would appear that more than ever, there are so many obstacles to young people being able to be successful in this country. There's lots of bad news all the time, and seems to be that it's very hard for people to break out, be successful. The institutions are against them doing it and so forth. But in reality, it's never been better, I don't think, in this country as opportunistic for young people. They just have to realize that what appears to be obstacles aren't really obstacles. There are very few people willing to work hard, but the ones who are willing to work hard are ultimately going to reap the benefits. It's a fair market capitalist system, and it's available to everybody.
Bill, you flew all the way here from Boston. Thanks for doing this. I really admire you. And thanks for 20 years of friendship.
Thank you, Jack. It's been a wonderful experience, and your friendship is very, very important to me.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula, and thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoken.